everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and just a great big speculative fiction nerd.
So this week was my choice, and I selected The Martian, the book by Andy Weir that was later made into a movie. And I did this because we're actually planning to do an Andy Weir doubleheader since Project Hail Mary just came out. And so we're going to do that as our next episode. So spoiler alert, we'll be doing that one next. But today we're going to be doing the original Andy Weir movie, The Martian. This is a story about a crew of astronauts that visit Mars. While there, they encounter a vicious windstorm during which one of their members, Mark Watney, is injured and presumed dead. The remaining five crew members evacuate the planet and begin their journey home to Earth. However, by monitoring satellite footage, NASA quickly realizes that Watney did survive and is currently living on Mars. Watney must solve a number of complex problems, including farming potatoes and retrieving a long-dead Mars lander in order to survive on the planet before his crewmates can mount a daring rescue. In the climactic launch sequence, the crew of Ares 3 is reunited after a year and a half apart, and Watney returns home to teach survival strategies to new astronaut recruits.
At some point, everything's going to go south on you. Everything's going to go south, and you're going to say, this is it. This is how I end. Now, you can either accept that, or you can get to work. That's all it is. You just begin. You do the math. You solve one problem, and you solve the next one, and then the next. And if you solve enough problems, you get to come home.
So that's my brief synopsis of The Martian. John, do you remember seeing this movie when it came out back in 2015?
I do remember this one. It was a bit of an event, I think, for those of us in planetary exploration or just space exploration in general. So a bit of a big deal at the time. And I remember reading the book as well.
Yeah, I do not remember seeing the movie. I must have seen it. But we had just moved to a new city and we had a two-year-old at home. So my memory during that time is pretty fuzzy. So I'm not sure when we saw it. I do remember very clearly, though, when I first heard about it. We were living in Florida and I was having lunch with a colleague of mine. And she was very excitedly telling me about this new book she had read, The Martian, and so convinced me to then go and read it. This was probably right after it had been picked up by an official publisher and published. Prior to that, it had just been informally published on Andy Weir's blog. So yeah, so once it was published and out in the world, I think more people picked it up and had a look. So I did read it again a long time ago. I reread it recently so I could remind myself what the book was about. But yeah, I don't remember seeing the movie. I must have seen it though. Maybe one of these days it will come to me.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating development story, isn't it? Right? With the website. And Andy Weir was actually soliciting advice and help from people who worked in space exploration. And as a result, you know, NASA and folks from space agencies around the world actually got kind of caught up and involved with the process of getting this thing created and put out there in the world. And we even see NASA involved in some of the awards ceremonies and all that. So there's this really, really tight-knit production that happens, which I don't know that I've seen in any other property.
No, it's pretty rare. I was surprised how involved NASA got in this movie. I mean, there's plenty of sci-fi movies out there, but they normally do not get this involved in them. Famously, when we were talking about Close Encounters, they refused to get involved with that, instead writing Spielberg a 20-page letter about how concerned they were about the movie. So to be this involved with it was a bit confusing to me. The only thing I could think of was that at the time, so we're talking 2014, 2015, the U.S. was not launching humans into space, right? The last shuttle launch was in 2011, and they were relying on the Russians to get people to the International Space Station. So I wonder if they were trying to, like, advertise human spaceflight to reinvigorate their own program. And it was only more recently that they were starting to send people into space. And of course, well, you guys are going to hear this months from now, but this week they're actually sending a bunch of astronauts to the moon on Artemis II.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the other side of it is that it just really appeals to the kind of person who's in an organization like NASA and just sort of the way they think. Like I noticed in the notes, you said that it felt like you were doing high school math tests.
Yes.
And sort of, I think that kind of, you know, you solve one problem and then you solve the next problem and then you solve the next problem. That has an appeal to the kind of person who winds up, you know, working at NASA.
Yeah, but not me. This is the thing I really hate about Andy Weir's books. I just reread The Martian. I'm in the middle of Project Hail Mary, and they all read like high school math tests. If you were stranded on Mars for 500 days, how many potatoes would you need to sustain yourself without starving? Show your work. You know, I mean, that's how the book reads, which is not particularly compelling from a character point of view. I really feel like this is one of those cases, and Project Hail Mary probably similarly, where the movie is better than the book because you have real life actors showing real emotions that just do not come through in this math test-like book. I don't know. What did you think about that, John?
Well, I think that's where I have some issues as well. And I will point out, dear listener, that neither Catherine nor I are at a space agency. Interesting that. So, yeah, I think I like more of that humanity. And as we get into this, I think it's going to be interesting for us to talk about places where I think they did a really good job adding that. And there's places where I think they might have gone a little bit too far trying to develop a bit of an atmosphere to some of the events. But we'll get into that.
Yeah, but simply seeing Matt Damon like react emotionally to really troubling things that are happening to him, you know, I think added a lot to it that was never described in any detail in the book. So I appreciated that about the movie.
Indeed, indeed. Well, what do you think, Catherine? Do you want to just jump right into the science gripes since we have, you know, one or two of them?
Yeah, I was just looking at the list of notes and it goes on and on, both for Science Shine and Science Gripes. I'll note that, but why don't we jump in? John, why don't you tell us about the biggest science gripe of this movie that everyone recognizes as the biggest problem, the windstorm?
Oh, 100%. I think Andy Weir even acknowledged that you know, he saw this as a bit of a problem. But you need some way to strand Mark Watney without really implicating the other astronauts or making them nefarious. So he decided to go for this interesting windstorm idea. So in the movie, you've got this sort of thing that comes in, this front of dust. And, you know, there's dust, there's wind, there's sand and gravel and things being thrown all over the place. It gets incredibly dark incredibly quickly, and things are just sort of thrown all over the place. And what ultimately is Mark Watney's downfall is that the high gain antenna that they have for communicating with Earth, apparently the only antenna they have for communicating with Earth, we'll get to that, flies off of its stand, hits him, impales him, critically impales his biomonitor so that the other astronauts think that he is dead, and then knocks him away distantly into the storm. And this is a problem because the Martian atmosphere is really, really thin. Here on the Earth, we've got one atmosphere of pressure, or one bar, as we often refer to it. And on Mars, you have only 6/1000ths of a bar. So 6 millibars, we call it, of pressure. So there's not much pressure there. There's not a lot of density. You're talking about less than 100 times as much density to the air. And first of all, that means that as you spin up the winds, you feel a lot less force on you from those winds. But you can't spin the winds up all that fast either, because winds come from a difference in pressure. If you have a high pressure in one area and a low pressure in another area, the winds flow from high to low. And if you're talking about something like a hurricane on the Earth, you can get 100 millibars worth of pressure change there. And that gives you those winds that are, you know, 100-150 miles an hour, you know, potentially. Whereas on Mars, you can't get that kind of wind power just simply because you are only working with like 6 millibars to begin with. So that creates a bit of a problem.
Yeah, the force is directly proportional to the density of the atmosphere, which, as John said, is less than 1% of the Earth. So it's really, really hard to spin up high forces with winds. And unfortunately for the casting characters of this movie, they did actually give a number. And you know what happens when they give a number, right? We're gonna nitpick it. So they said the wind force was an excess of 8,600 Newton. I don't know how they knew that, but they gave us a number. And I did the calculation, and it would require a wind speed on the order of like 4,000 kilometers per hour. Which is completely unrealistic, right? It's 10 times higher than the highest wind speeds ever recorded on Earth. And as John mentioned, it's unlikely that wind speeds would get up as high on Mars as they do on Earth. So it's just ludicrous. I don't know why they gave a number, but clearly they were way off.
Well, they just had to be technical, right? And if you look at scenes later on where there's the fix that Watney does to the Hab, and that's fluffing in and out. That would require a 20,000 kilometer an hour wind, which is also crazy.
Yeah.
But even when he's hit, right? And we have a look at this. So let's say that there is some anomaly there. If you pick this object up and pull it off of its moorings, you know, and it accelerates for a couple of seconds and then it hits Watney, you need something like a 460 kilometer an hour wind to do that. But even if that happens, given the gravity on Mars, given the speed at which that high gain antenna is moving, he's only going to be like knocked down. He's not going to be like swept away. So
yeah, he was like,
I don't know,
more than 100 meters from the Hab. Or I was trying to guesstimate it when he starts walking back to the Hab, but he was far. Like, he got really launched into space there during that storm.
Yeah, if you're launched 100 meters by being hit by an object, you're also probably very dead.
Well, the gravity's less, right?
Gravity's not everything. It's just, this is really, you know, like you said, this is the MacGuffin of the movie. It allows the movie to happen, but it's the least realistic thing in there.
Yeah, yeah. So how would you strand a character on Mars in a more realistic way, John?
So if it were me, I would go human factors. I would go with something nefarious, right?
Mm.
Or someplace where they know that he is still alive, but they can't do anything about that. Because you are at the tyranny of orbital mechanics, of the environment of another planet. And it could be that you get your crew separated, and one set of the crew has to leave, and they leave the other crew member to die. So, yeah, I think the human factors thing or that kind of thing is more likely. But then you've got the problem that the you know, you can't have that drama with the crew that's headed back to the Earth.
Yeah, I thought maybe, you know, he could have, like, sacrificed himself to save the rest of the crew, and they all think he's dead, but it turns out he survived somehow and then is stranded. So it's kind of like he sacrificed himself for them, and then later on they sacrifice themselves for him, so it'd be a nice kind of bookend to the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
But that's not the movie that we're dealing with.
No. So what really stuck out to you, aside from the windstorm?
Oh my gosh. I've got a long list of things. Why don't we start with farming? I know everyone remembers the potatoes from this movie and the farming of potatoes. And over the past few years, I've actually been growing potatoes in my own backyard. So I'm becoming a bit of a potato expert, although apparently not as much as Mark Watney, because I can't grow as nearly as many potatoes as he can. So this is this thing. He brings in like Martian soil to grow these 16 potatoes that were left for them for Thanksgiving. So that's the big idea. They didn't send freeze-dried potatoes. They sent real potatoes so they could have a nice Thanksgiving meal during their stay on Mars. So there's a couple of issues with this. First of all, let's start with the soil, right? The Martian soil. It's not great to grow things in. I actually had a student undergrad try to grow plants in different lunar and Martian regolith simulants, and we could not for the life of us grow anything in the Martian regolith. I don't know entirely why, but the whole, like, the pot just turned into concrete. I don't know what was in it that caused that. But worse than this, on Mars, there's something called perchlorates, which is this awful salt that would be really not great for plants. And you'd really have to wash the soil quite a bit in order to get rid of them. And there's no evidence that Watney did this. So yeah, so the soil would be not great to work with. And then we got the potatoes, right? He's only got 16 potatoes. And you need to have an eye to plant it. So it's that little like bud when your potato starts to go bad and starts to sprout, there's these little buds all over it. Those are eyes. And you need one or two of those in order to grow a potato. First of all, I hope these potatoes didn't have eyes on them, right? You don't want to be eating like this old mushy potato. So, but there's no evidence he left it out to kind of like grow old and sprout. Okay, but let's just ignore that. Okay, so he does have like a number of eyes, but you know, you're not going to cut your potato up into tiny little pieces, right? Maybe at most you could get 6 pieces from a potato with a couple of eyes on each. And so he's got 16 potatoes times 6, right? We're talking like, I don't know, 70 potatoes you could plant. But when you look at his farm, it's huge. I was trying to guesstimate it. It looked like about 20 potatoes in a row and about 20 rows. There's no way he had enough to plant 400 potatoes. So yeah, and then they don't really, like they make a big deal about him putting his poop in the soil to make it add that organic material. But you'd also need live bacteria from fresh poop. And they do deal with this in the book, but they never mention this in the story. Like, he's using freeze-dried poop for his fertilizer, which would not be great. So yeah, there's a number of problems with this whole farming aspect. And his potatoes, again, I know he's a botanist, but he grew so many potatoes, right? Like, I try to grow potatoes in my backyard on Earth with an oxygen atmosphere, with sunlight, with water. And it's rough going. Like, it's really hard to grow that many potatoes. I would never survive on Mars given my potato farming knowledge.
It does bring up an interesting question, I think, about soils, right? And what makes, you know, a soil? Because when you go to other planets, when you go to the moon, we don't have soil. We have this thing called regolith, yeah, which is basically just broken up rock on the surface. And what a lot of people perhaps don't realize is that soil is not something that's manufactured. It's something that grows, and it takes a long time. So when you get like a fresh volcanic eruption, get a mountain that starts to break down, there's all of these different generations of different kind of plants that go in to sort of break this up in different kinds of microorganisms. And so, you know, even if you had the fresh stuff from yourself and the other astronauts, it's not clear that you've got the right bacterial cultures right in there to properly grow the soil in the first place. You've got fertilizer, but you don't necessarily have what you need to make healthy sprouts.
Yeah. I will say we did get plants to grow in lunar regolith just by adding fertilizer to it. So it wasn't impossible. It's just they were a bit stunted, I would say, perhaps not as healthy as an average plant would be. But yeah, that's important. A lot of people hear the word soil and they just think about dirt, but it's more than dirt. Soil by definition also has organic components to it. So we wouldn't find that anywhere else in the solar system. And it'd be really difficult to build up a healthy soil that you could use to grow crops in.
So I think the next place I'd want to go is the communications, because the communications, the orbital imagery, all of this stuff really builds attention in this movie. And some of it's not great. So I don't love the single high gain antenna with no omnidirectional backup. We never design even robots that way. With the Galileo probe, famously, it had an umbrella-like high-gain antenna that got stuck and never opened. And so all of the communications with the Galileo probe that went and visited Jupiter was with that low-gain, that omnidirectional, slow antenna, which gives you sort of the equivalent of texting. So there's no way that this base would not have that kind of a backup. It would be insane to design it with just one antenna. So that's one thing. The other thing that drove me a little bit crazy is the idea that to communicate through the Pathfinder spacecraft and the Sojourner rover, that they needed to set up a copy of that, what we would call an engineering model, on the Earth, and that somehow these two magically talk to each other. But you still need to send the bits through the Deep Space Network, and, you know, people at JPL are not dumb. They can see that happening, and, you know, there has to actually be, like, handshakes and all of this going on. So that part of it was just really, really implausible to me.
Well, right. Presumably the HAB can talk to the rover, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they don't technically address that, but you'd think the HAB and the rover could communicate. So that means both of them probably have some sort of radio on them. And they might not be the strongest radio, but, you know, if you happen to point it towards Earth, you might be able to get some data there on over a long time frame.
See, you're making me think of new things here, right? Because that rover, it does have the ability, you know, with its range to go over the horizon. And so it needs some kind of way to independently talk to the Earth. And the other thing is that since the early 2000s, the way that we've primarily talked to spacecraft on Mars is through orbital relay,
through
satellites up there. So it just seems a little bit, you know, it stretches credulity for us to imagine that all of the radios are gone.
Right, right. And they clearly have orbital assets, right? They're taking picture after picture of him. So, I mean, he might not even have to communicate with Earth. He could just talk to the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter equivalent of 2035, and they could communicate back to Earth. Yeah, yeah. It's another bit of a MacGuffin here, I think.
Oh, yeah, but the NASA director, who, of course, like in all good science fiction, lives at NASA Johnson.
Yes, Houston, that's right.
He won't let them take pictures, you know, and they've got to request satellite time.
Although they did correctly identify that the data has to become public, right? That's what their concern was. I think
I did like the PR thing.
They were avoiding taking pictures because they didn't want to like transmit his dead body because they would have to release the data, which is true. NASA, since it's a public agency, does have to release data to the public after a certain time. Yeah, let's talk about Pathfinder, though, our little buddy that he uses to talk to Earth. So this was a mission that was sent to Mars in 1997. It was one of the first missions to land on Mars in a very long time. I think the last one before this was Viking in the 70s. So there had been a big gap in our landed knowledge of Mars. And so everyone was understandably very excited when Pathfinder landed. I think we might talk a little bit more about Pathfinder and the Science Shine, but right now I want to gripe about how Watney finds Pathfinder. I guess it would be like 40 years later, because the movie, according to Andy Weir, is set in 2035, and it's just covered in sand, which is probably not realistic, given how quickly things get buried on Mars. We actually have an image of Pathfinder. The most recent one I could find was in 2007. There's an extremely high-resolution camera currently orbiting Mars. It's called HiRISE. It's on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It can take pictures with 25 centimeter per pixel resolution. It's basically a spy camera around Mars. And so it's taken lots of high-res images of the surface, including of the Pathfinder landing site. Like I said, they saw it in 2007, and it was just sitting there on the surface. It was not covered with sand. So that doesn't seem super realistic. He also finds it by pulling on the cords of its parachute, but Pathfinder wouldn't have been connected to its parachute at that point. It actually used a pretty cool technology, which they went on and used for later rovers, the Mars Exploration rovers, where they basically put it in a big airbag, and then the airbag like bounced around on the surface, protecting its cargo inside before eventually deploying the spacecraft. So it wouldn't have been connected to the parachute. It would have bounced around with this airbag. So that's what he should have found instead of the parachute. Yeah, so the whole, and when you look at the area of Pathfinder in the movie, it doesn't look anything like the area where Pathfinder actually landed. So yeah, the whole thing just kind of, and this would have been so easy to do. I mean, we have pictures from the Pathfinder site. They could have just replicated it. Right? I mean, they were working in this giant soundstage in Hungary, I guess. So they could have just made a Pathfinder-like universe in order to set this.
Well, it's an interesting thing, right? Because on Mars, the landscape changes very slowly. Not fast enough, I think, for Ridley Scott. And the amount of fallout that you get is only something like 10 microns, like 10 millionths of a meter of dust in a year in the places that we've been to. Even numerical models of places that we haven't been to, it's only like maybe 100 or a couple hundred microns of stuff. So it takes a very long time for things to get buried. And we don't get the same kind of sand movement you get on the Earth. There's still the same kind of saltation, but it's very slow and it's in very few places. Again, because the wind power is just so absolutely low. So the kinds of things that they used to start creating this atmosphere of like all of those sand and gravel grains ticking off of the off of the hab whenever, you know, Mark Watney needs to, you know, be moody and think about his situation. Or during the storm, you know, which gets much darker than it ever gets at the surface of Mars. These are problems. And there's lots of little things like that throughout the clouds. We do get clouds on Mars, but not that thick, because it's just the Earth with a filter, of course. And then they add in dust devils, and we do see a lot of dust devils on Mars. And oddly, some of them, especially later in the movie, are done quite well. But again, in those sort of, you know, moodier parts of the movie, they look like tornadoes in the distance.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Yeah, apparently a lot of this was filmed on Earth in the same place where they filmed Rogue One, and they just kind of put a Mars filter on it so the sky wasn't blue. So parts of it were filmed on Earth, and then other parts were filmed in a big soundstage in Hungary. And you can tell, because a lot of it doesn't look much like Mars. You know, the Ares 3 landing site, there's these huge buttes surrounding it, which, again, why would you choose that as a landing site? You know, it seems very dangerous to be so close to a steep cliff like that, right? And it's not at all what Astalia Planitia, or more properly, how do you say this? Chrissy Planitia? How do you say that one?
I've heard Chrissy, but
Chrissy Planitia?
I don't know for sure.
Yeah, so they say they're in Astalia Planitia. They're more like in Chrissy Planitia. It's a little bit further south, but neither of them look like this. So I don't know why they chose to use that, other than the fact that they were just filming in on Earth, and that's what the landscape looked like. So again, they could have probably tweaked this in the soundstage, but they didn't. I guess they were going for atmosphere over realism, which is fine.
Well, you know, we talk every so often about we need to land in Valles Marineris, you know, for the good PR photos. So maybe that was the idea here. You know, at least he didn't go to Petra.
Another big problem I had, speaking of Pathfinder and JPL, is why is JPL designing a resupply mission for a human mission? JPL does not do that. They're not in the human mission aspect of NASA. They primarily design, you know, planetary probes, missions, and the like to other planets, not anything to do with humans. Somebody in this field, that really took me out of the movie. You would assign that to probably Johnson Space Center or another NASA center that deals with human exploration, not JPL. So that was very bizarre to me.
Yeah, and it is fascinating to me that the top brass were really, they were involved in the technical details of all of this stuff, which is not my experience of agency executives. But again, you don't want to have to bring in even more cast members to explain that to the, you know, the people watching the movie. So I understand kind of why they did that. I think an area where you and I disagree a little bit is in terms of the spacecraft that JPL ended up designing here. And that spacecraft, I'm sorry, dear viewer, it does not make it. It has some issue with liquefaction of some protein cubes, which makes it spin uncontrollably. You looked up some potential details here. I think I'm still skeptical,
okay.
But go ahead.
Okay. Well, I mean, he goes into exquisite detail about this spacecraft failure in the book. Again, it's like a math test. There's more detail here than I need, but he has pages and pages about this spacecraft failure. So the key point is that they don't do inspections for the spacecraft, right? Because they're trying to save time to get it to Watney as quickly as they can. And so it turns out that there's this bolt that's not quite perfect holding it onto the spacecraft fairing. And the point here is that the protein cubes, basically they're solid food particles and oil, right? And when the gravity is really high, as you get in a spacecraft launch, the food particles are going to compress, but the liquid will not. And so what he's going for here is that it turns into sort of this liquid, which sloshes around and puts pressure on this imperfect bolt. The bolt fails, and then the spacecraft explodes. So I don't know if this is right or not. This is how he explains it in the book. John, you seem unhappy with this explanation, though.
Yeah, like unbalanced load is like one of the big dangers of really any kind of aerospace project. And so that's why when you see them loading up the spacecraft, they're not just like tossing boxes in there or, you know, having a chute, you know, with corn or something like that. Everything is very meticulously boxed and packed and secured in these white fabric cubes. And the reason for that is that even if one of these cubes escapes or something goes wrong inside of that, it doesn't threaten the whole spacecraft. So you do have instances of failure where you have very big containers. So one example that Catherine found was the second Falcon 1 launch that SpaceX did, but that was sloshing within the entire liquid oxygen container, which was not constrained in any way. So you could have liquid sloshing from one end of the rocket to the other almost. Here, it doesn't look like the kind of place where you can have that happen unless the failure was like in every single box and they were all just running around. So I don't know. This one seems a little forced to me. You know, I know he's done the math, but I'm not buying the problem.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't have strong feelings about this one. Again, it's another excuse to have the Hermes crew have to turn around and go get him in a very dramatic climatic scene at the end. So, you know, he just had to find some reason to have the spacecraft explode.
Oh, yeah. But I feel like if he's going to make it about the math, we have to hold him to the math.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of ways for rockets to explode, to be fair, right? But he really wanted to write pages and pages about these protein bars separating and this bolt that didn't quite work. Yeah, the book is very detailed in a way that I didn't quite remember, you know, this decade later. I remember Project Hail Mary being this detailed, but I've forgotten about The Martian. And I think he did actually learn something between those two books. And as annoyed as I was with Project Hail Mary, I think it is slightly more character focused than The Martian, which is just like straight up math problems, the whole book.
Definitely. So before we talk about the things that we like, because this is a movie that gets a lot right, is there anything else you want to cover, Catherine?
Oof, gosh, I've still got so many notes here. I don't know which one. Well, this is going to come up again. So why don't we talk about the pressure in the hab and in his spacesuit? Because they make a big deal about showing like numbers inside the hab and in his spacesuit about what the temperature is, what the pressure is, all these things. And one thing that really stood out is that the pressure in the hab is 12.5 PSI, which is very close to sea level pressure on Earth. It's actually what the International Space Station does. It's also kept at one atmospheric pressure. But his spacesuit is very clearly at a lower pressure. I think it was like 4.7 PSIs, which is also typical. Spacesuits often have lower pressure than the habitats. But what this means is like the abyss, which we talked about last time, you have to very slowly adjust to the pressure changes. So you have to kind of go through this depressurization routine. And for the International Space Station, it takes like 45 minutes to an hour to go through this process. And they never address this, right? He's just hopping in and out of the airlock. No cares in the world, putting his spacesuit on and off. And later on, when he gets to the Hermes, again, like those astronauts are just bouncing in and out of their spacesuits trying to rescue Mark. So yeah, you seemed concerned about this pressure too, John.
Well, for me, it was the fact that this is a fairly quickly constructed base. It's only meant to last a month or so. And what you tend to find is that the higher the pressure that you design a habitat for, the more problems you get. So with the spacesuits, they're at a lower pressure to, you know, make that design work a little bit easier. If you have a big rigid structure, keeping it one atmosphere is potentially helpful because that's good for the health of the astronauts. But something that looks like it's kind of kludged together a little bit and kept there by the interior pressure, I would imagine lower. So that the first pressurized aircraft, so like the Boeing 707 in the 50s, those were kept at more like 8 and change PSI to reduce the wear and tear on the equipment. And I kind of feel like for something that's only meant to last a month, that designing it for 12 and a half, that's maybe not the best design decision. I do like that the airlock does fail, right? Because he's definitely stressing that way more than it would have been designed for something like this. You know, the failure method is a little weird, but at the same time, you know, it is interesting because like you say, they're showing us the pressure in every scene that has something like this going on. We get the information. And I feel like I'm just not convinced by this one.
Yeah, and if it was pressurized 12.5 PSI, that fix he does for the airlock where he puts that big tarp over it,
yes,
you know, should not be blowing in and out with the wind, which again are very mild on Mars. You know, it should be puffed out and stays that way, right? Like a balloon. Because you're basically inflating it from the inside like a balloon. If it was waving in and out, you know, you've got bigger problems because that means the pressure in your hab is almost nothing and Mark's probably dead inside, right?
Oh, goodness. And I mean, you even looked up about duct tape, right? And it probably does not have the strength, especially at those temperatures, it needs to even do that job. You know, sorry, duct tape.
Yeah, in the book, it's done completely differently. He doesn't try to patch his helmet up with duct tape. He just uses the oxygen in his suit to fill up the airlock, which was still intact, and then like rolls it back to the hab. So they chose it to go a different route with the movie compared to the book. That was perhaps not quite as realistic.
One last thing, and this is entirely for atmosphere, is that aerodrome beacon drove me crazy.
Yeah.
And I think it would have driven the astronauts crazy too.
I didn't know why they had that either. Other than it looks cool. But why would the astronauts need that?
Yeah, like these are typically used at airports, typically small airports, maybe without air traffic control, that see the odd little night flight. But I don't know. I don't think Le Petit Prince is coming into this location.
The other thing that really bothered me were the maps he had of Mars. They looked like 50 years old, right? We've got such good maps of Mars. You know, like I said, 25 centimeters per pixel images of the surface of Mars. And he's working on some, like, I don't know, topographic map from the 70s with contour lines. It just stretched believability. So I was joking that couldn't have Commander Lewis have packed any maps from this century?
Well, I think we could go on for hours here, Catherine. Maybe the best thing to do is to put a pin in it here. And we'll be right back in a couple minutes with the Science Shine. All right, welcome everybody. back to the show. And this is the part where we talk about the things that we liked about the movie. And, you know, The Martian, it's a movie that does its homework. It did not get 100% on the test, but it did do quite well. So let's talk about, you know, some of the things it does right. So what really appealed to you, Catherine?
Oh, gosh. What really appealed to me? I think there's a lot of little things, which is good, right? It's good to pay attention to the details and do the little things correctly. Why don't we talk about the landing site, though?
Sure.
When I first saw that they were landing in Astalia Planitia, I was like, oh, well, that's good. Because I'm working on a project where we're trying to design a radar instrument to study subsurface ice on Mars for use by human astronauts. And when you want to send humans to Mars, you want to send them to a place where they're is probably subsurface water available. And so this is typically in the mid-latitudes. We know there's ice near the poles, but it's too dark, it's too cold up there. So we focus more on the mid-latitudes. And Astalia Planitia is one of these places that might actually have deposits of subsurface water. Actually, I was a total nerd and I went onto this software called JMARS. Anyone can download it and you get these beautiful maps of Mars. And I found the location of Mark's Hab on the map. And I tried to see if there was any evidence for ice. And there's this great consortium of scientists called the Mars Subsurface Water Ice Mapping Project, or SWIM. And so they've assigned a score to different parts of Mars to tell me whether or not it's likely that there's ice there. And they gave this region a score of 0.5, where 1 is the data are fully consistent with the presence of ice, and 0 means that there's no indication of the presence of ice. So 0.5 is pretty good. So there's a good chance there is subsurface ice in this region in the top 5 meters. So yeah, this is probably where you'd want to go to look for ice and have humans settle. Although it does beg the question why Watney didn't try to dig up that ice to use for his water rather than try to blow himself up by turning rocket fuel into water. Yeah, but I thought the landing site seemed realistic for a human mission.
Yeah, I think there's a bunch of those details, right? Like, speaking of the water, that whole making water thing is actually quite reasonable as well. So spacecraft tend to have a lot of what's called monomethylhydrazine on board. And it's a wonderful and highly toxic material that is really great for space travel because it's what we call a monopropellant. So we don't need an oxidizer and a fuel in order to burn it. It's something that decomposes into both oxidizer and fuel if it touches what's called an incompatible metal. And fortunately, Mark Watney had some incompatible metal lying around, some iridium.
Yeah, where did he get the iridium? He had these little pellets, but I didn't know where they came from.
Yeah, the pellets were weird, I thought, because presumably what you would do is you would go to the, you know, to your landing vehicle and you'd take those plates off that you spray the hydrazine onto. Often those are made of platinum, so you have that kind of material going on. And there are some good things about this. The main product of the combustion of the two halves of monomethylhydrazine is water. There are some less good things that also come up, and you get incomplete combustion. You know, anybody who has observed the tailpipe of a car can see that you get incomplete combustion. So those things would be bad. So that goes under the rug. We store that, you know, in cubes to go back on the next spaceship. But here, it's neat that this is done right and that he uses the chemistry. So, you know, that's just, you know, kind of fun, I think. So I like that.
Yeah, and they make reference to the founding of JPL, where they almost blew themselves up. And that apparently is a true story. I guess there was a group of grad students known as the Rocket Boys in the 30s, and they were playing around with rocketry in their dorm room and caused a small explosion, which got them kicked off of the Caltech campus. And after a bit of back and forth, they eventually founded the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in the foothills of Pasadena. So they were rewarded for their explosions in the end.
Yeah. Like some of the visual aspects, I think, look really nice. You had picked out the spacesuits, and I think it's been something in science fiction for a long time, this idea for Mars of having restrictive spacesuits that don't actually keep, you know, our bodies in using pressure the way that EVA suits do on orbit, but that actually have like elastic material that keeps everything in place. And you actually found some nice history of this in the research world as well.
Yeah, so I was a bit concerned when I saw the spacesuits, because you would need a pressure suit on Mars. As we talked about previously, the air pressure is less than 1% of what we have on Earth. So you would need a pressure suit. And most of the time, how, you know, NASA does this is they have air pressure, right? So you're kind of in these like little balloons that you're walking around in. So when you look at the lunar astronauts or astronauts on orbit, they're just filled up with air to keep that pressure. But the movie designers did not like that look, and I can't blame them. It's not a great look. But apparently there has been some work done by a group of researchers at MIT to solve the pressure problem by just making a skin tight spacesuit, kind of like a wetsuit, I guess. So they want to like shrink wrap astronauts. And then when you're done, you can kind of loosen it and get out and get in again. And this is a really cool idea, which I hadn't heard of before, that people were working on this, because I think it would help a lot with the mobility of astronauts when they're trying to walk around. So you're not, you know, just kind of like trying to bounce around in a balloon of gas, you know, that's not very good. So yeah, it's cool that people are looking into these more skin tight wetsuits that would help astronauts move around better.
Now, one challenge with a suit like that is it doesn't do necessarily a great job of keeping you warm. So you need to, you know, add some,
right.
You know, some warming filaments and things like that in there. But, you know, for longer term use, Mark found a very interesting way of staying warm. And mm-hmm. that was by cozying up with a piece of hardware that we use a lot in space travel called an RTG, for a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. These are really fascinating devices, and they are so simple in terms of operation. What you want to do is you want to get yourself a little bit of plutonium, and we're specifically looking at a isotope of plutonium that their main property is it stays warm. So these are, you know, red hot ingots, and they have a half-life of about 77 years. So what we do is we encase these in devices that are very similar to a thermocouple, which measures temperature, but hooked up backwards so it generates energy. Not very efficient, about 8% efficiency at generating electricity, but they're also really great for generating heat. And aboard some of the spacecraft that we have sent to Mars, like the Mars Science Lab or the Perseverance rover, we actually pull the energy out, the electricity out, which is not that much. It's only about as much as a light bulb. Well, a light bulb before LEDs, about 100 watts. And we harvest some of the thermal energy through a fluid loop as well. So what Watney does is he goes out and he digs up the RTG that they had buried. And he covers that in what looks like, you know, multi-layer gold insulation. And he puts that in his rover. And that might seem like a bad thing, but this is not a nuclear reactor here. This is material that is basically just hot. It is, you know, releasing some radiation, but nothing too bad.
Yeah, it should be blocked by your skin, essentially. So it's not super dangerous to humans. You'd have to eat it.
No.
for it to be a problem.
Don't eat it. Yes. Yes. And this stuff is very well protected as well. So each one of those little ingots of plutonium is in a little aeroshell that's meant to survive the rocket it's launched on blowing up. You know, this is a thing that NASA and the Department of Energy pay a lot of attention to. It also turns out that the amount of power output, the amount of thermal output you'd expect from this, actually is about the right size to warm the rover by the amount that it does. So, you know, again, you know, I'm going to check correct on that particular exercise in Andy Weir's workbook.
Yeah, I was surprised how much thermal energy they put out. I knew about their electrical output, which is, like you said, about 100 watts, but it's for Perseverance, it's putting out 2,000 watts of heat, which is impressive.
There's a friend of the RTG called the RHU, or radioisotope heating unit, which is basically the same thing, but much smaller and without the electrical energy generation component of it. So this might be like a gram of plutonium that gets put in strategic places of spacecraft to keep them warm.
Yeah, so they use RTGs to warm spacecraft, you know, for Curiosity and Perseverance on Mars. And for Dragonfly, which we're designing for Titan, it also will have an RTG, and we'll use it to keep the interior of the spacecraft warm, so at temperatures where electronics can work, as opposed to the temperature of Titan, which is 90 Kelvin. So, yeah, good job, RTGs. Thank you for your service.
Indeed. Well, do you want to jump to the really mathy part of this things done well and talk about the hex stuff?
Right. So, I mean, you can debate whether or not they actually had to use the hexadecimal system to communicate with Earth. He thinks that, okay, well, you know, there's too many letters in the alphabet, essentially, and it will be too difficult to tell 13 degrees apart from one another with Pathfinder as it's spinning on its axis. So he's like, okay, well, we're going to use hex instead, which is base 16. But the benefit here is you can turn any letter or number or symbol using just 16 values, A to F, and numbers 0 to 9. And so you can put these together into a certain way to make different letters. So for example, Mars, in capital letters, mind you, not lowercase letters, is 4D for M, 41 for A, 52 for R, and 53 for S. So you could communicate that to him, 4D, 41, 52, 53, and he would know that you're saying Mars. In all caps, because you're screaming at him. But yeah, so it's perhaps a slightly more efficient way of communicating than with the alphabet, which is 26 letters long, plus any symbols you might need. So, you know, you can debate whether or not you need it, but it is a more efficient way of communicating than with the alphabet by itself. I don't know. What did you think about this, Don?
Yeah, I think, you know, I might quibble there because you're moving from 26 letters to 16, so it's not obvious that one is a dramatic difference over the other, and you can add something on the camera to make it more clear where it's pointing. But it's a fun way to, I think, nerd out. There's a lot of people out there who have coded in things like hex and whatnot, and so it's a nice little shout out to them, I find. And it's not the only little thing when it comes to the coding. So, you know, you found that, you know, when he's doing his coding on Mars, when he's using a computer, the sequence of code looks right. I noticed that the supercomputer that they are using at NASA, you know, is also what it's currently called. Although I should point out that Pleiades, I think, is being retired, so it might not be there in 2035.
But why was he using a supercomputer? I mean, orbital trajectories are not that difficult to compute. You don't need such a fancy computer for that calculation.
Well, it depends on exactly what level of fidelity he's doing, but I'm with you that for the answer he was looking for, he probably didn't need that. Plus, they seem to be able to manage just fine on the Hermes, and they don't have a supercomputer there.
Yeah. Anyways, it you know, they just wanted to show a scene of Donald Glover freezing in the supercomputer room, which is realistic, right? These rooms are cooled down because the computers overheat. This is why AI is such a problem, because they need so many of these supercomputers, and they're just like sucking up so much energy to cool them down that it's an environmental problem at that point.
But I think it's pretty rare for people to go into the data center and to plug a USB.
Rare. Yes.
Yes.
But my husband used to work for the University of Arizona for their computing department, and they did have a supercomputer there, and he had his server room sweater that he had on the back of his chair for whenever he needed to go in there and fix something. So it is a real thing.
So the things that they're actually calculating are pretty good as well. There's one point where the NASA administrator throws out just sort of, you know, haphazardly, you know, like, oh, that's when the Hohmann transfer window is coming up. And that's really good to see as well, because you have these low energy transfers between the planets. You can't just go to Mars whenever you want to. In fact,
well, you can,
you know,
it just costs a lot of fuel.
Yeah,
you need a lot of fuel.
Yeah.
And it might take longer and et cetera, et cetera. So.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a time that maximizes the amount of payload that you can bring with you. And that's when you've got this setup where, you know, Mars and the Earth have these concentric orbits, and you link them together with an elliptical orbit that starts at the Earth's orbit and then goes all the way out to Mars. So that's the lowest energy transfer. And that happens about every 2 years or so. You can go, like Catherine says, at other times, but either you need a lot more fuel or you carry a lot less material. And generally speaking, the way that chemical rockets are these days, we don't bother because it's not great. So yeah, that was neat to see that referenced, I think.
So for a time, yeah, you would see Mars missions come up every 2 years. 2012 was Curiosity, 2014 MAVEN, 2016 InSight, 2018 I think there was ExoMars, or was that earlier?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. 2020, I think, was Perseverance. So yeah, you just, for a while there, we just had Mars missions every 2 years. It's also a plot point in For All Mankind, when they were all racing to get to Mars and to get to the 94 window so they wouldn't have to wait 2 years for the next window. So yeah, I also appreciated that call out to the home and transfer window. And then they got some of the numbers right, too. You know, they're talking about trying to catch Watney as he's getting launched off of Mars and his ragtop and using numbers like, oh, you know, I could probably catch him at 10 meters a second, but 42 meters a second isn't realistic. And that jives, right? 10 meters a second is 36 kilometers an hour, which is like a really slow moving train, whereas 42 meters per second is 150 kilometers an hour, which is like, you know, you're going to get caught by the police speeding down the highway in your car. So yeah, there are, and apparently, you know, Weir did his homework and got the numbers right here during the sequence where they're trying to slow down the Hermes enough so it can catch Mark.
Yeah. And I think there's some nice stuff that they do that as well. Like the, you know, getting that, all that weight off of the MAV really will make it move faster. And the MAV was not designed it was only designed to go back up to orbit. It wasn't designed to match speeds with something that is heading back to the Earth. And so, you know, I like that they actually demonstrated that fairly well. Now there is the question of, you know, could Mark Watney move 400 kilograms in his shockingly emaciated state?
That's right. Right.
But, you know, I'll give them that.
Right. What did I work it out? It's like, sorry, how much is it on Mars? It'd be like 330 pounds. It'd be the equivalent of lifting 330 pounds on Earth, which personally I cannot do. And I'm not in an emaciated state. So
he makes it happen somehow. And I do enjoy, as they're trying to match with the MAV as they swing by Mars, that, you know, there's a lot there about how space flight, how orbital mechanics is just not really intuitive to human beings. And they're trying to do various things to get them closer together, but they start at hundreds of kilometers apart. And as you mentioned, tens of meters per second difference in velocity. In the very end, Mark Watney needs to, you know, punch a hole in his suit and to try to catch up, you know, that way, but that also is a very imperfect system. So I enjoyed that. It's not just like, you know, oh, spaceship's over there, right, I'm right, going to go in that direction.
Right. Or you could be in the right place, but you're going too fast, or you're going the right speed, but you're too far away. You have to line everything up just right. So I just have one more thing before we move on to Of Its Time. I was really surprised to learn that this bomb that they made with sugar and liquid oxygen is a real thing. It's called Oxyliquid, which is, yeah, a liquid oxygen explosive, which people have used in like mining and the like, where you mix the liquid oxygen with some sort of organic compound. And it has an explosive power similar, if not more, than dynamite. I guess it's not very stable, though, so I'm not sure how often it's used. But this is a real thing that has been used in mining applications and so forth in order to create an explosion. So, I mean, it wouldn't be my go-to because, you know, chances are you'd probably blow yourself up before you get it on the airlock. But it is a real thing that has been used on Earth, which was a surprise to me. Had you ever heard of this before, John?
So not this specific one, but there's a lot of stuff out there on the internet. Don't try this at home, you know, kids. Especially mixing like liquid oxygen with Doritos, for instance, which has a lot of energy in it.
Luckily, it's hard to get liquid oxygen. So, you know, it's not something you can just go down to the grocery store and pick up.
Thank goodness. So the last thing I'll end on is just, we have seen so many of these movies and films by this point and TV shows, and they always have to put in a call out to the distance between Earth and Mars, and they're always wrong, except for now. Now at least they get the average distance correct. If 50 million miles from home, the difference in the semi-major axes of the two orbits is 48 million miles. So I'm impressed. Finally, we
guess
have...
I guess they finally heard us.
Exactly. All right. Well, that takes us to the end of our Science Shine, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with the Of Its Time section.
All right. Welcome back. So now we're into the Of Its Time portion of the podcast. This was a movie that was filmed in late 2014 and then came out officially October 2nd, 2015. Although I guess it premiered originally September 11th, 2015 at the Toronto International Film Festival, which I found a bit surprising, but released to the general public October 2nd. It comes from a book, The Martian, written by Andy Weir, which we mentioned. This was written around 2011 and was released for free on his blog. In serialized format, he would get feedback from readers and then kind of incorporate it into updated drafts. It got to the point where people wanted to be able to read it on Kindle, so he put it on Kindle for like a dollar and people could download it there, and that got the attention of a publishing group, which purchased the rights and then, you know, packaged it up for official publication. You know, at the same time, 20th Century Fox got interested and optioned the novel in March 2013. And so they started developing the film at that point. Interestingly, though, the screenplay was not written by Weir. It was written by Drew Goddard, who also, I noticed, wrote the screenplay for Project Hail Mary, and directed by Ridley Scott, which I was surprised to hear. When I think of Ridley Scott, I think of horror and Alien, and this is not that. This has more heart to it and less horror. So I think he did a good job, though. It worked out well. And it did really well. It grossed $630 million worldwide, 10th highest grossing film of 2015, and Ridley Scott's highest grossing film to date. So pretty impressive movie.
Yeah, it's really interesting that because we associate Ridley Scott with such iconic properties, but none of them really did all that well at the box office, despite the kind of cultural cachet and prestige that they've had. So it's interesting that this is the big one for him.
Yeah. Like I said, it's probably my favorite of his, and I didn't even know he directed it until very recently. Yeah, it was also the cast. I was pretty impressed with the cast. You know, a lot of big names. As someone who's a fan of Marvel, I noticed that there were a lot of Marvel folks. Sebastian Stan, who was almost unrecognizable, they did a good job, I think, differentiating him from the Winter Soldier. And then, of course, Benedict Wong, who's Wong in Doctor Strange, and Chiwetel Ejiofor from Doctor Strange as well. Even Matt Damon, I forgot, had done a bit part in Thor Ragnarok, pretending to be Loki in this stage adaptation of the story. So yeah,
I remember a lot
of Marvel folks, which made the Iron Man reference at the end all the more appropriate. So yeah.
Now, at the same time, my argument here is that so many actors have been in the Marvel universe that it is very difficult to construct a movie without a significant number of them, but
yeah.
I digress.
Yes, yeah. Especially at this point in time, it's been going on for 15, almost 20 years. So yeah, fair point. But it was fun to see all those characters. Although there was some criticism about people they selected to play different roles. For example, and I apologize if I'm saying his name incorrectly, Chiwetel Ejiofor played Vincent Kapoor, but in the book, the character's name was Venkat Kapoor, and he was, I think, pretty clearly South Asian descent, Hindu religion, and they kind of, well, I know he's black, so it's not quite whitewashing, but they made this change to make him more American than Indian, and that was a choice. I guess they did try to get an Indian actor to play this part, but he was busy doing something else, so they switched it around. Andy Weir doesn't seem that concerned about that. He said his novel intentionally avoided physical descriptions of his characters, but I mean, when I read it, I pictured this as an Indian character, so they definitely switched that up. And then more egregious, I think, though, was Mindy Park, who was played by a white woman in this movie, when in the book, I definitely got the impression that she was Korean. Park is a very common Korean name as well. So anyways, the Media Action Network for Asian Americans were not very happy with some of their casting decisions, kind of depriving Asian actors of opportunities for roles that were clearly written for Asian actors. So that was a bit of a misstep, I think, for this movie.
Well, it is interesting, right? Because the way I often think of it is that a movie is not a book, right? It may be based on one, but it's not the same thing. And they can go in a different direction, and it depends on who's available and how well they fit into the story that the filmmakers are trying to tell. There's a really, really big change that was made that I don't think anybody is upset about because it turned out so well from the 90s. So do you remember The Shawshank Redemption?
I do.
Catherine?
I do.
So not the main character, but the main supporting character, who's played by Morgan Freeman, is actually an Irishman named Red.
Oh.
From in the book. And in fact, they actually deal with this tension in the movie, in that somebody asks, you know, Morgan Freeman's character Red why they call him that. And he just goes, oh, I guess it's because I'm Irish. And then they all laugh and move on. But again, it's they had such a good actor available, and he fits so well into the story that Frank Darabont was trying to say, that they went with somebody very different, you know, in terms of, you know, the look of it compared to the book. So there are places where it can work really well. And so I hesitate to say that filmmakers are required to hew exactly to what they see in the book.
It was a pretty white movie, though, overall. Mm-hmm. All of the astronauts, except for, I guess, Martinez was Latino, but they were very white, right, overall. So, I mean, I can kind of see the criticism when the book tried to include more diverse characters, and they didn't quite accomplish that in the movie. You know, in some of the characters, they didn't really even state what their background was. So they could have had mixed race characters, and they just chose not to.
No, that's true. Maybe a good place to go next is just talking about NASA's input, because we talked about this, I think, at the start, and you know, never have I seen, like, there's lots of science fiction out there, but never have I seen that kind of involvement. And I think part of it is just the way that it came about, with this being released on a website, with Andy, we are looking for feedback and getting that feedback from a lot of people who worked in NASA. So there was a constituency for this before it even came out as a book. And then when it came out as a movie, and it looks like, you know, that went even deeper, involving folks like Jim Green, who is the director of the Planetary Science Division, asking for specific images, looking for details from the centers. Although I will say that having been to Johnson, yes, and to JPL, their reception area does not look anything
the movie. They, Ars Technica described its depiction as the space agency that we all dream of, and the opposite of the real Johnson Center's appearance as a rundown college campus, which sounds about right to me.
Yeah.
Didn't look anything like Johnson Space Center. Maybe got an upgrade in the 2030s that we have yet to see.
It just makes me think a little bit about how we actually carry out space missions. So I've been on a number of these now. Usually there is a flashy mission control that we use. And you've got that particular reality. That's where the media goes. That's where the politicians go. But the day-to-day running of the mission is like card tables and blacked-out rooms with laptops. So, you know, it's interesting that you don't have quite that flash in quite the same way. And so when they build it up even more for these movies, it's interesting. Like, I mean, Johnson Space Center looks almost like the Smithsonian, for goodness sake.
Yeah, yeah. I guess they did give the production designer an 8-hour tour of Johnson Space Center so he could kind of get the sense for what the space agency looked like, took hundreds of images. I mean, they clearly gave it a bit of a glow up in the movie itself, but it was based, I think, on the bones of what NASA looks like. The other cool thing I thought is that JPL also really got into this and hosted a Martian Day to promote the movie and highlight the agency's efforts to go to Mars. And if you go to their website, there's this cool little online website, Mars Trek. So it's sort of a way of viewing Mars on the internet based out of JPL. And you can actually choose the Martian path and follow along where Watney's trek to from his original starting point, Nastalia Planitia, over to Schiaparelli Crater. Oh, which I didn't mention. They used the wrong crater in the movie. I looked it up. I was like, is that the right crater? No, it's not. It's so easy. Why'd they make that mistake? I digress, but you can follow along with his journey from one site to the other on this actual website that folks use to study Mars. So I thought that was kind of a fun thing. I'll also note that, like, NASA did all this work for free. It's a government agency, so they can't charge people. So they were advising all these movie makers free to the movie makers. Maybe this is why they don't do this more often, right? It's a huge pull on their time when the movie makers aren't paying them for it.
Well, it's hard, right? Because public outreach is a big part of these space agencies, what they do. And even us as researchers at a university, public outreach is important because all of these space missions that we run, they're funded with public dollars. There's this need to really give back and explain to people, to share that that excitement of discovery and what it is that we're doing. And movies are an interesting way of doing that because they reach such a large audience compared to anything else. Like, I can give a public talk, we can have this podcast, but the number of people that we're going to reach, you know, maybe soon we'll have, you know, a bigger audience than The Martian. But these movies, this is really where you get bang for your buck. And especially a movie like The Martian, which shows NASA in a good light, which talks about the actual challenges of spaceflight in an intelligent way, this is the best vehicle possible to get this kind of a message out. And I mean, I've done film advising. We had some fun with that in season one, you know, folks. I hate to say it, but that's probably the most eyeballs I have ever had on something where I've contributed to science communication.
Yeah, no, you make a good point. And as we mentioned earlier, right, at this point, NASA was not launching humans into space. So they had a real need to sort of advertise NASA's ability to send humans into space and to try to get interest in that so they could then eventually get people back into space. So this was in 2015. The last shuttle launch was in 2011. And then the first SpaceX Dragon launch with people on it was in 2020. So there was a huge gap of a decade where they weren't sending anyone into space. So I can see where they maybe wanted to build up that hype for eventually sending humans back. Now, whether or not we could actually go to Mars is another story. It's very difficult, as we've talked about in the past. But certainly, NASA is very seriously looking into sending humans to the moon right now with the upcoming Artemis II launch and then future Artemis launches as well.
So something I have to bring up, because we talked about it last week, is the music, right? Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how the music locates things in time. But this is the future, right? And so with the future, you get a choice. You get to either create something completely new and weird that people typically do not remember, which has happened in some movies, or you get to revive something from the past. And they pick a very specific era in this one, don't they?
Yep, I hope you like 70s music, because that's basically the entire soundtrack to this movie.
It's all from one character. This is another, you know, maybe unbelievable thing that only one of the astronauts has their music loaded.
So right.
Poor Mark Watney is forced to deal with all of this 70s music.
No one else brought music?
Apparently not.
I guess Johansson's hard drive was too filled up with old 80s computer games. She didn't have any room for music.
Well, the really shocking thing is Mark Watney didn't bring his own music.
Yeah, right. And they
so he has no reason to complain.
And they couldn't send like data when he you know reconnected with NASA with Pathfinder. Oh man. Anyways, maybe he secretly likes 70s music and he just didn't want to admit it to Commander Lewis.
I think that's probably what it is.
Yeah. There were a couple of references that stood out to me. So one thing I'd never heard of before, when they're reconnecting with Mark through Pathfinder, the controller said, oh, this is not going to be an Algonquin roundtable of snappy repartee, you know, going back and forth, just asking yes and no questions. And this is not something I'd ever heard of before. Had you heard of this before, John?
No. It actually went completely over my head.
Yeah. So I guess it was a group of New York City writers, critics, actors from like the 20s who would get together at the Algonquin Hotel to have lunch and engaging in wisecracks, witticisms, and I guess they wrote newspaper columns. But yeah, this is not something I'd ever heard of before. But so it seemed like kind of an obscure reference here. I'm not sure. Maybe one of the writers was a fan of these folks.
It does sound like maybe it's not an Andy Weir sourced reference.
Yeah, that makes sense. Maybe it's a Drew Goddard reference here, because it was not something I was familiar with. And then I also caught when the NASA administrator slash director, we're not really sure what he is, was on the phone with the president. He does explicitly say, thank you, Mr. President. So I was disappointed that in 2035, we still do not have a female president. I'm really hoping AOC 2028, something. We need a change, right? And it'd be nice not to have yet another Mr. President, another 10 years in the future.
So another thing you talked about, the prevalence of the Marvel actors, but I have to say that I enjoyed the reference to the Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, that was there for the nerds, which was all of us, right?
But so great to actually have, you know, the actor Sean Bean in the room for that.
I know. I do like Kristen Wiig, who's like, how do you guys all know about this stuff? I mean, and even me, who've seen the Lord of the Rings movie, has read the books, I don't think I would have picked up on the Project Elrond reference. So these guys are all deep in the weeds in terms of the Lord of the Rings lore.
Which is, you know, to be honest, that is completely accurate for the folks who work at space agencies who we went to grad school with and are still friends with.
Yes. I guess I'm not quite one of them, though. I'm pretty nerdy, but I'm not on Project Elrond level nerd. The other thing I noticed, they had a big product placement from Cisco in a lot of the scenes when they're talking to each other over the video calls, which were not actually super common in 2015. That was kind of new. But I did appreciate the Cisco call out because up until very recently, JPL would only use WebEx for all of their web conferences. So I'm on a lot of programs that are led out of JPL. I was on the Cassini mission, which was led out of JPL, and we'd have a lot of these video calls with WebEx. So I appreciated that call out, although these days, most of our video calls are on Teams or Zoom. So John, you said ESA still uses WebEx though?
Oh, they like WebEx. Everybody has their favorite, right? So ESA uses WebEx. They've moved over to Teams, you know, at the Canadian Space Agency and down at NASA. I did not spot any Red Hat. There's an awful lot of Linux at JPL from what I recall.
That's right. And somehow we're working with China. So that gives me hope for the future because right now it's illegal for American scientists to work with China. There's currently a law in the books that prevent U.S. scientists from working with those in China. Not something I would necessarily endorse, but it seems like by 2035 that they're working together. And certainly the China National Space Administration would be a logical partner. They're a real powerhouse in space exploration. It wouldn't surprise me if they landed people on the moon or Mars before NASA did at this point. But, you know, so that's good. There are some things, though, that perhaps were a little bit of its time, even 10 years ago. They used the term manned mission a lot when these days we refer to it as the gender-neutral crewed mission. That's where the language is heading. And then Mark brags about colonizing Mars, which, you know, is perhaps not the best choice of words in this day of age when we're talking a lot about how to decolonize our education system. Colonization definitely has some attributes to it with a less than stellar history. So maybe that's not something you want to brag about. And then lastly, I definitely kept my eyes open when they were in Times Square to see what businesses were around. And I noticed a Forever 21 store. And so I looked it up. It turns out it went out of business last year, which I didn't realize. Are you familiar with this store, John?
I can't say that I've ever shopped there, but I've seen it in many malls.
Yeah, so I guess it went bankrupt in 2025. So probably wouldn't have been around in 2035. I guess they got taken over by JCPenney and now are online only. So no Times Square Forever 21. I was a bit surprised, though. Maybe I'm too jaded, but do you really think like thousands of people would turn out to Times Square and Trafalgar Square and all these locations around the world to see if one astronaut survived a trip to Mars?
So there's an interesting parallel here. We can kind of run the experiment because Apollo 13, which I'm sure we'll do in upcoming season, they talk a lot in that particular movie about how people are over the Apollo program and nobody cares anymore and none of the networks will carry them. But when the astronauts run into trouble, then they are, you know, on the screens in Times Square and all that. So I think that comparison makes a lot of sense. Whether people would go to Times Square for anything, that's a separate kind of question for the culture today. Maybe you wouldn't get as many people as you got in the early 70s when all that music was on the radio. But maybe I think you'd get more of an outpouring than you might imagine.
All right. Well, speaking of music, why don't we just end? I didn't realize that The Martian actually won a Golden Globe for Best Motion Picture Comedy or Musical and Best Actor in a Comedy or Musical. I did not think this was a comedy or musical, but maybe the 70s music turned me around. I guess a lot of other people didn't agree with this decision either. And so now they've changed the rules so that dramas with comedic overtones can no longer be considered in this category. They have to be entered in the drama category. I guess they were just trying to avoid stronger competition in the best motion picture drama category, but kind of a funny tidbit.
I don't want to jeopardize our potential position, you know, with the Hollywood Foreign Press, you know, and our ability to win Best Podcast, Catherine. You know, controversy at the Golden Globes over, you know, the selections in each category. I'm shocked.
I love the Golden Globes. They're just kind of, they're like the fun Oscars. Anyways, anything else you want to say in this section before we wrap things up?
No, I am ready to go to the ratings.
All right. So this is the portion of the podcast where we rate the movie in terms of its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how does it hold up over time. John, how did you rank this in terms of its scientific accuracy?
So I gave this one a 4. You know, my rule of thumb here is if we're talking about the science gripes for more than 30 minutes, that means we've got something good on our hands. And I think that's true. There's a lot of effort put in and a lot of help to make this as accurate as possible. It doesn't succeed everywhere. but it does a really good job. I'm giving it a 4.
Yeah. I also gave it a 4. I think they did their homework here and tried to make it as realistic as possible. And understanding that you have to add some perhaps less scientific elements in order for the story to proceed and for the excitement and the drama to unfold, I'll give them a bit of a pass for some of those errors, which were done not because they didn't know what they were doing, but to tell a good story. So I also gave it a 4. I think influence, though, I think we disagree a bit here. What did you give it for influence?
So I gave this one a 4.5 out of influence. I think it's just a shade off of the full 5. Like it was a cultural thing at its time. It's Ridley Scott's biggest movie, which is just absolutely insane when you look at his filmography. And I will also invoke the For All Mankind rule in here, in that the people who are creating the future, they know this movie, they know it well. It is beloved in that particular community. So I don't know. It's not a whole series spanning generations like Star Trek or Star Wars, but in terms of the amount of influence that one movie can have, it's just a shade away from, you know, absolute.
Yeah, apparently the astronauts watched this on the International Space Station. and they had a page from the script on the Orion capsule that went up in 2020. So certainly I think, yeah, the nerds like this movie. But I think in terms of the general public, I don't think it's that well known. So I gave it a 3.5. Much like Close Encounters, everyone remembers the potatoes. But beyond that, I don't know how much of an influence it had on the average moviegoer. I ask my class who has seen these movies, who has read these movies, and, you know, a few hands go up, but not a ton. And yes, these are, you know, early 20-somethings, but this movie would have come out when they were in their teens or that around that age. So you think of it influenced anyone, it'd be them. And I just don't see it as much amongst the general public. So I'm going to give it a slightly lower score. But, you know, I think it holds up pretty well over time. I gave it a 4.5 here. It does still look really good. Again, I watched it with my husband yesterday, and he kept saying, yeah, it holds up really well. And I think it does. You know, the CG effects were at a time where they were evolved enough that they still look good 10 years later. And this is a movie I think I would continue to watch and enjoy into the future. John, I think you also gave it a 4.5.
Yeah, I think this one holds up really well, too. It's only been 10 years, so that's of course, going to be part of it. And as time goes on, things will diverge. The big test, of course, 2035, you know, how does it look, you know, 10 years from now? You know, maybe we notice more than just like the missing Forever 21 store, for instance. But you never know. This one does seem like they put the time and the care into it. And we've seen in the past when that happens that things can hold up very well for quite a while. So 4.5 for me, I've got to say.
All right. Any last words before we wrap things up?
No, it's all you, Catherine.
All right. Well, until next time, I'm going to science the SHIT out of this planet. See you next time.
Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.